Oh, you remember what the 16th was like when you were young? All the small people were in bed early, wrapped up in their special pajamas, but they'd never sleep. They dreamed of this night. They dreamed of dreaming about this night, and they fidgeted and fussed and dreamed again. And downstairs, some carrots and a glass of milk, your father's supper. But eventually, he would make his way to bed. And in the morning, as they do once or twice a year, the neighbors would call round and exchange gifts and shake hands, even with the children. And the phone would ring, and it would be your dear cousin. And you'd say, "Martin, how are you? Happy St. Patrick's Day."
Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. I'm Rachel Brown. In this Serpentine episode, Ian Sansom doesn't talk about snakes with Manuela Moser or with Gil McConnell or with Jimmy McAlevey. Padraig Gregan's poems, as far as we can tell, do not contain snakes.
Hello, I'm Manuela Moser. I am a PhD student at the Seamus Heaney Centre. I'm from Morecambe in England, and I run the Lifeboat reading series and poetry press.
Can I just unpack a couple of those things before we go any further?
Yeah.
So how did you end up here from in the first place?
I came here to come to Queen's. So I've been at Queen's for 8 years.
Oh, right. Gosh. Mm-hmm. Were you doing the MA first and then the
undergrad.
Were you?
Yeah.
I wasn't here then. No, I don't
no,
think
you,
so.
No, you were, but I took...
You didn't take any of my courses?
No.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Noted. Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
So you did the undergraduate and then the MA and then the... Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Uh-huh. And are you kind of, as far as you... That must be... It's not a record, but, I mean, you're one of the... That's an unusual thing to do, is it, or not? I mean, that whole kind of undergraduate, then the MA, then the PhD, all in one place. I don't know. Maybe.
It's quite unusual, but I think there's quite a lot of people here who've done the same.
Right, okay. Yes. And so can I ask, would it be appropriate for me to ask what your PhD is on?
Sure, my PhD is on long form poems. So I'm looking at Bluets by Maggie Nelson, Citizen by Claudia Rankine, and The Men by Lisa Robertson.
So they're like, they're
book length poems.
Books that look like poems that they're not really kind of, what are they? What's your working definition of these things then?
I'm trying to figure it out at the moment. Long form poems book length poems is where I've got at the moment.
Right. So it's just pure size. Is it just heft? What's the relationship between, if you like, quantity and quality? Are there technical similarities, if you know what I mean, between the things that you're looking at that make them appropriate, not just in terms of their size, for your kind of purposes?
I guess I'm looking at things that are playing with genre and using a mixture of verse and prose, and maybe images.
And is it essentially what I would think of as a PhD PhD, i.e. it's not one of those crazy newfangled creative and critical PhDs?
Oh, no, I'm definitely doing one of those.
Oh, you're doing one of those? I'm guessing then at the same time then you're actually producing your own long form.
Yeah.
Right, okay. And can I ask you thematically or otherwise, what are you playing around with there? Or anything?
Thematically, I guess I'm playing around with themes about refugees and the world, as huge as that sounds. My grandpa was a German Jewish refugee, so I'm thinking about him, and he died a couple of years ago and I was there, so there's a bit in the middle about him dying, although you can't actually tell in any point that someone is dying. And then just kind of me looking at the world and thinking about where we are now, because it's all a bit messy.
Right, okay. And you're seeing connections between the kind of your grandfather's experiences and where we're at now? Is it that kind of...
Yeah. I didn't want to write something that was just looking back.
Right.
Because I thought that would be... Well, I mean, I think it's good to be forward-looking.
Right.
And not just... looking at the past.
Okay, yeah. And was he a Kinder transport?
No, he came over with his brother and his parents in 1936.
Right.
So his dad
good move.
Knew. Yeah. His dad knew. His dad was a banker and just saw everything happening and realised that they needed to get out. So they waited a while for their grandmother, like as a lot of people did. They didn't want to leave the old people behind. And then I think she died and they managed to get out.
Mm. And did you address that before in your writing? Had you kind of wrestled with all that before?
Yeah, I have. And I think I wrote lots about it in my undergrad. And that's why I decided that I didn't want to be looking directly at that anymore and just kind of use it as a backdrop now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you might have you got something up your sleeve to read to us that might be either from that or something else?
I do.
Yes,
I have a poem called Trains that's about one of my relatives who was in Berlin a few years ago, and she told me the story, and I wrote it into a poem. Do you want to hear it?
I would love to hear it.
Okay.
Are you kidding me? It's the Pope Catholic.
Okay, trains. Now open the door onto a train carriage in Berlin 3 years ago, where Annie, my second cousin, is sitting next to David, her husband, and a couple of friends. The ticket inspector, making his way down the aisle, checking tickets, stops before Annie and David and their two friends and asks to see their tickets. And when Annie hands them over, he says, "You did not check these tickets at the station. You are meant to check these at the station." And she replies in German that she didn't know, that she's not from here, and that she didn't understand the system, and sorry, it won't happen again. But he says, "You haven't checked these tickets. You will have to get off at the next stop and check them." She repeats she is sorry. Could he let it go just this once? And she promises to check them next time. But he shakes his head and repeats what he has said. When the train stops at the next station, he signals the conductor and waits by the door until Annie and David and their two friends step down onto the unknown platform and slowly make their way across the city to the Holocaust Museum.
A terrible June. Who'd have thought this wine made from the flowers of wild gorse would turn out so well? How were the flowers ever convinced to give up so much of their coconut aroma, their slick and electric yellow? On the radio, a tenor is bouncing his voice around Purcell's baroque arpeggios, and this is the fourth clear day in a row, and that strong light is throwing shadows over the ground like Gothic script. I've been walking around the city being beautiful, and I have photographs to prove it. I've learnt recently to make myself beautiful by a certain sweep of the fringe, or forcing a correspondence between my nails and my lips by bringing each to the same pitch of red. To think I'll have to go home later and try to sleep while my skin hums with all the heat it's absorbed, these hours spent marvelling at everyone's tulips. Their heads are like little novas. Often I envy the Scandinavians for their months of sun unpunctuated. I think I want some kind of salad. I want to feel like a real boy sometimes.
So just ignore all the bangs, and it's just people, obviously, so that'll be fine. Now, you should... I know who you are, obviously, but you should probably...
Do I, though?
Yeah, well...
Do I?
This is the question. But for our purposes here, you might want to... Reveal.
I might. Somebody was saying the other day, it was Bob Scanlon, was saying that he once said to Beckett, "But what do you yourself think?" And Beckett said to him, "Me, myself? What are you implying?" Anyway, my name is Gail McConnell, and I am a lecturer in English at Queen's, and I have published some criticism of Irish poetry. And I have also published a pamphlet of poems and a long poem. And I'm working on my second pamphlet of poems, which is coming out later this year.
Is it quite, so you would be quite unusual, would you be unusual? Maybe I don't know enough poet critics, critics slash poets, whatever you, I mean, I don't know how you would style yourself. Mm. Would you put the poet slash, would you put the slash before, between the poet and the critic, between the critic and the poet? Or and if so, and how does the slash function? Or is it a slash? Perhaps it's an M dash.
What is it indeed? I don't know, because the poet side of things, or the poeting side of things, is relatively new. And I'm not sure. I mean, I've always been warned that there aren't that many good poet critics, really. There's less than a handful. So you've got to worry when you get into, you know, start having to think about the slash and where you would put it. So I just think of myself as, well, I don't really know. I don't like to think of myself, really.
No, fair enough.
Best not.
Yes, yeah. But you started with the, so you were what I might think of as a fully kosher academic. Well, you still are a fully kosher academic, but so, someone who does academic literary criticism.
That's right, yeah. So my PhD was thinking about theology and form, really, trying to think about structures of thought and feeling, theological ones, in the work of Seamus Heaney and Derek Mahon and Michael Longley. Not about belief, because none of them have belief as such, but thinking about how theology influences how we... ideas about subjectivity and literature and form, really.
And what is the, what is the, I mean, I'm not asking you to summarise your entire PhD in a couple of minutes, that would be nice. what are the structures? How do those structures of feeling make themselves apparent? So is it really technical? You're addressing technical questions rather than questions, as you say, of belief in the
PhD. With Seamus Heaney, I was thinking a bit about ideas of incarnation, but also transubstantiation. And thinking about those in relation to how an idea of real presence, I suppose, might find a kind of secular poetic equivalent, as if kind of poetic language could find a sort of, have a kind of incarnational presence. So I thought in particular about a poem of his called Blackberry Picking, early poem where the blackberries appear as fruit, but also as blood and as wine. And, you know, Heaney's interesting in the way that he writes about Catholicism as a sort of, in that sort of Dantean sense of it being kind of an imaginative realm of possibility for him, really, without orthodox belief. In the case of Michael Longley, I thought a lot about the influence of George Herbert on his stanzaic structures. So a couple of his early poems, his poem A Personal Statement, for example, takes up the stanzaic structure of George Herbert's Denial, which is itself just a brilliant poem. With that sort of theological crisis, really, of, you know, crying out to God in a voice and knowing that, or articulating in that same voice, that the God to whom one cries will not hear the voice crying it. I'm paraphrasing it badly. But I thought a bit about the influence of Herbert and of kind of more sort of Anglican ritual on Longley's stanzas, and how, you know, we have a lot of religious architecture in Longley's poems, but the cathedrals are often bombed, or they're waste sites, or they're made to decay and crumble in different ways, and that seems to be important to Longley's purpose, because there's kind of a ritualistic impulse, but also a sense in which historical violence and what that means about, what that tells us about our capacity for violence as humans, really, means that the cathedral kind of must of necessity be ruined, and the rituals must kind of be broken, and the masonry must be sort of crumbling. And then Derek Mahon, as you would expect, take things to a much darker, more Calvinistic extreme. He has a poem called Matthew 5:29-30, in which is a poem about self-excoriation, which basically is about sort of self-annihilation and the end of the world, and the crisis for him, sort of what he sees as sort of the failing of language to really have any kind of, not even just incarnational, but also ritualistic purpose, means that there's kind of a really destructive impulse in his work. And one of the ways this manifests is that he's a notorious post-publication reviser of his own work. So he goes back and fiddles with all his poems and often makes them worse and changes titles and moves things around. And
sometimes makes them worse.
Sometimes makes them worse. Are there ones that you
I don't know. I come off. Let's not.
Anyway, this is all very serious for an issue on St. Patrick. For goodness sakes, we shouldn't be in the realm of the theological.
Well, no, this is exactly where we want to be, I think.
We were going to talk about snakes and things.
Well, we can talk about snakes as well, but I'm interested in the kind of the way in which some of your kind of critical concerns in the fashion that you've just described might then be seen in your own right. And what's the connection between that and
Who knows?
You're doing?
Who will you tell me? What do you
reckon? Well, I don't know. Well, if I'd have to. Shall I go? I'm actually gonna go and get the book off the bookshelf, which is under. I hope it's
right. Listeners, I would like to tell you that this
is
really
right,
taking
I've got
place.
The book.
Okay.
Hold on.
Okay.
Okay. Good.
Ampersand. A rope trick, a mangled anchor, a misshapen treble clef. A knot instruction illustration. A figure eight with benefits. A bind. An et in trebuchet like a backwards B. A lemniscate gone rogue. An infinity upended and enlarged by ligature. And more and more and more and... Do you say et? That was the one I thought. Do you say a?
Yes. No,
et. It is et.
Yeah,
and et and trebuchet. I've actually
good.
Never read that a lot.
Yeah.
Thank
have
you
not?
That. No,
no,
I haven't,
no.
No.
Oh, it's...
It's funny, there's certain poems in this book that I just think, no, you need to see them, really. And that's always one of them. But actually,
no, I think read aloud, what you've done, that's because I love that. Love, that's the and more and more and more and more.
And.
That's
oh, good.
Just,
I mean, that's good.
Oh, it's absolutely magnificent. So... No, is there anything? I sometimes when we're talking to people, the man with the drill seems to have gone away. So I'll ask you the question that I always want to ask people, which is, you know, when you're talking to someone, and then you walk away, you shut the door behind yourself, and you think, I wish, why the hell didn't they ask me this or that question? Because I'd really like it if somebody. There's always something that we think, God damn it, man or woman, why didn't? Is there something that we've missed that was glaringly obvious where you think? Oh, that would have been such a good thing for me to try and explain. I think what we might do is we might have a whole separate kind of Heaney Centre kind of podcast, which we just call What I Meant to Say Was.
I don't know because it's, no, I don't think I can think of anything. I'm staring at this map of Europe 1918 to 1937, which I'm quite enjoying looking at. But no, I don't think of any. I mean, we didn't talk about what I thought we might talk about, which is fine and good. I thought we were going to talk about St. Patrick.
Yes, well, I suppose, I mean, there was a bit of a swerve around St. Patrick suppose. I mean, if there's anything else you want to offer about St. Patrick, I'd be interested to know, was it, when you were growing up, was it part, my sense of it here now, is that it's bigger than it used to be, but maybe it's not as a thing.
Than it used to be. Yeah, it was a bit of a known event. Schools Cup rugby final is my memory of St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Is that when they used to have it?
Yeah.
Oh, they still have it.
They still
do,
I think. Yeah.
Right.
And usually culminates and
okay.
The
that's a peculiarly Northern Irish activity, isn't it?
Yeah. Very. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And would you ever go? Would you go?
I would.
Was it black chaps? Only playing rugby at the time, was it? It
yes,
wasn't,
and still is, yeah.
Right,
and still is,
yeah.
Protestant chaps mostly.
Right, okay, yeah. Fine, yes.
But yeah, but no, was it St. Patrick's Day? No, it was a bit of a non-event, really.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, would you? I mean, this year, for example,
I barely remember that. You know, it was a day off work.
Is it a day off
it's
work?
It's a day off work.
Oh,
is it?
Bloody
no, it
hell.
Is Monday. Is
right,
it?
Okay.
It must be.
Right,
surely.
Okay. Well, I look forward to that.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, you see, even though I've lived here for 30 years, it's still not part of my kind of mental. It doesn't figure in a funny way.
No, and strange way for me too.
Yeah. Well, maybe on that distinctly downbeat St. Patrick's note, we
hence
should
the swerve.
Yes, yes. Maybe we should. Maybe we should just say thank you very much.
Salt Island. I wanted to make it gothic of it all. The trees on the slope where the island dipped into the sea, their weird kinks and angles. The scrap of wool where a sheep had rubbed a flank against a tree's arthritic fingers. The cloud quilt which was then breaking up as though someone had pulled the one thread which held the whole clump of vapours in place. I walked over the hill with my kilt flapping and thought, wow, all this for me. And the weather just kept getting better, rescinding its earlier threats of rain. The mood was ruined, I wanted ice cream. In the photographs I scroll through now in bed a week later, I see that my red tartan clashed with the grass so perfectly, I wonder if I intended to be the punctum, the little rip in the surface where my eye might snag. It is too early to tell if I've succeeded, and too early in the morning, the sun not yet visible behind the hills, to tease out what it means when all this naming of the island, wool, sheep, trees and clouds is just another way of saying I.
My name is Jimmy McAlevey. Hold on, I'm going to try that again with good teeth. My name is Jimmy McAlevey, and I'm a lecturer at the Seamus Heaney Centre in Queens.
How long have you been?
6 years.
Is it?
Yeah, it's coming up to 6 years.
Right. Yeah. And what were you doing out of interest? What the hell were you doing before that?
I used to write things.
Right. Well, you still do that now, in fairness, don't you? But
yeah. Yeah. No, I was just a writer.
Yeah.
In the house.
Are we?
Going mad.
Right, okay. Yeah. So it's quite nice to be in an environment with other people going mad in one big house.
It's certainly nice to get out of the house.
Yeah. Yeah, because it is a bit of a... I find that. It's quite...
Oh, yeah.
You think that's the one thing you want to do, don't you? If you're a writer, you think, just leave me alone, I'm just going to go.
Yeah.
But actually...
Yeah. Well, this has taken me years to realise this.
Right.
In Martin Amis's experience, he talks about the life of a writer and how you have to like being in your dressing gown.
Right.
All day, you know.
Right.
Number one, I don't have a dressing gown. But
just silk pyjamas or what? What's it? Or your smoking jacket doubles up as your dressing gown, is it? Or your barber. What is it?
It's I just seem to hang around the house in my wee trunks. You know?
Right.
But as I was saying to you earlier... I mean, after a period of weeks of this, you know, I emerge blinking with enormous hair.
Right,
I'm quite mad.
Right, yeah.
And it's taken me years to realise that I need a balance between that. And, you know, it can transform my day just to meet somebody in the street.
Right.
I mean, all those meetings, because it's Belfast, all those meetings are, you know...
There's quite a lot of them. That could take you all day, couldn't it, frankly, yes.
Yeah, but they're all, you know, they're full of wee quips, and you're only allowed to get away, you know, once you've made the funniest joke,
right, you know,
and then you can scamper off, while the other person's laughing, you know.
Yeah.
But that has transformed my form for the day.
And were you always, when you were just writing, were you just, was that for years, was it, that you kind of, so to just take me through the trajectory of how the hell you embarked upon this, whatever you want to call it. Let's not call it a career, but you may wish to call it a writing career.
Yeah. One night when I was very young.
What are we talking?
I don't know.
We won.
Yeah, I don't know, and I don't really want to go there.
Right.
I was lying in bed, wrestling with the idea of my own mortality and God, which at the time, the concept of God at the time, I found completely unconvincing. And I was in the horrors, you know.
Right.
And I decided that I would be a writer, and that would somehow be, if not a cure, but a balm to my forthcoming impending extinction.
Right, right. Were you brought up in a religious house?
I was.
Right, okay, just checking. I just wanted to get my bearings there for a minute.
Yeah,
right,
I mean, not insanely religious, right. You know. but you know, a Catholic, Belfast Catholic household that would have been typical of the time. Now, it wasn't that I thought that this would confer some kind of immortality on me in terms of like people would read what I had written when I was gone, you know. Because that's no fucking use anyway.
No.
Sorry, let me repeat that. That's no use anyway. Because you'd be dead at the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was something to do with existing in some kind of parallel
universe. Ah, right. Okay. Another world. Another world. Kind of that you had.
Another world that was somehow timeless and deathless.
Right. Yeah. And did you start then as a wee one, just were you writing? Did you start writing little stories or what?
Yeah, I did. I won the post office letter writing competition twice, in a row.
Right, I bet that was a fix, wasn't it?
They were wee short stories. Actually, I just started writing short stories again, and it just occurred to me the other day how similar they are to the ones you know, they're like Rider Haggard or Jules Verne or something, you know.
Well, you've just gone back to that now, recently.
I have a secret prose habit.
Have you?
Yeah.
See, lots of writers do have a thing on the side, don't they? It's interesting talking to people, isn't it? Where you say, you know, I talking to a novelist, they say, well, I do dabble in the poetry a little bit. And you say, I didn't realise you were doing the short story. How long have you been doing that? How long since you've gone back to that?
About 2 years ago, and I'm writing a collection of short stories.
Right.
I probably have a bunch of them. But they're at that lovely stage where I haven't invested too much time in it, too much of my self-esteem. And it doesn't really matter.
So you're just playing. You can be. Isn't that part of it? It's something you do with your other hand, isn't it? Almost. It's like where you could be, and you feel that you can maybe do things you can't do in your main enterprise.
Exactly, and it's exactly that. And I get to do the things in that I can't do in plays.
Right.
That I'm not allowed to do in plays. That audiences won't allow me to do.
Right. Like what sort of thing? Just.
Well, they're stylistic. Primarily, they're stylistic experiments.
Okay. You're worrying me now. Go on. Now, what are we talking? Are we talking kind of modernist, postmodernist, kind of playful jouissance? What are we talking here?
No, I don't have any jouissance in my DNA. Right. No. They start off quite naturalistically, and then they go somewhere fantastical.
Right.
So, for instance, one of them, it's called The Book of Joby. It's about a guy called Joby who's a spoofer.
Right.
But he's a very unconvincing spoofer. You know, every bar has one.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I was kind of interested in the psychology of the rubbish spoofer.
Right, okay. Like a Walter Mitty, like I would, you'd think of it as,
I mean, I come from a generation that scorned St. Patrick's Day. Sure. I mean, it's back now. There used to be nothing in Belfast to mark St. Patrick's Day.
I can remember when I first moved. Yeah. It was just nothing.
I mean, it was both about the politics and but also, like, you know, experienced pub goers used to disdain people who would come out on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, lightweight, kind of once a year.
Drinkers. Or, you know, you would have people who would have a drink problem and would be largely off the drink, but would go on the drink for St. Patrick's Day and would be rotten by midday, you know.
Right.
So we kind of looked down our noses at it. However, I did remember something relevant because now I am the second hardest playwright in Belfast, so I want you to be...
Second hardest?
Yeah.
Into just... As a wee hard man type hard, are we talking here? Right, okay, fine. Yeah,
so I just want to get that clear.
The second.
Yeah, just want to get that clear first.
I think I know who the first might be, yes.
Yeah, Murray Jones. But I was about to say an irrational fear. Is that remotely irrational? I have a fear of going to a wee room where a man or a woman will pull teeth out of your head.
Right.
And then you give them money.
Yeah.
Right? So where do you see this?
Oh, good God, man.
All right, so
if you could pick that up,
shaky teeth.
Good grief.
That's from smoking. So, I'm not going to the dentist. But anyway, so I had to get this tooth pulled out, right? And I went along quivering.
Right.
And they gave me the shots in the gum. That was fine. I'd also got some diazepam from somewhere.
Okay.
I took those.
You're prepared.
Yeah, absolutely no effect, right? So and you get the shots, and then you go back down the stairs. So they've shown the condemned man the instruments of his torture, you know?
Right.
And then you get to wait downstairs for 10 minutes contemplating it, right? And even though I could see the receptionist sniggering at me. So I went back up, right, to get this tooth pulled out of my head, out of my mouth. And the man's got the pliers on it, and it's going as he's pulling it out, right? And I have taken so much Paracodol over the years for hangovers.
Right.
That the stuff doesn't take, the anaesthetic doesn't take, right? So I'm lying there and he's doing this and I hear this sound, right? And I'll do it for you now. I was as surprised as you might be. And it went like this. I started singing Hail Glorious St. Patrick. I don't even know the words, but somewhere in my childhood, which had deposited itself somewhere in my being, specifically in the roots of my teeth, was this hymn that was about being brave for God and Ireland.
And it was there when you needed it.
And it was there when I needed it. And on Erin's Green Valley, on Erin's Green Valley, on Erin's Green Valley, look down in your love. And he did. He looked down. And out came the tooth, and off I toddled over to the aerial where I had a large Hennessy brandy.
The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast is produced in a small back room by Ian Sanson, Stephen Sexton, Rachel Brown, and Chantal Aylesby. With thanks to Nick Boyle for his music.